We're talking about Jonah again this week, the second week on Jonah. This is that part of the story where Jonah is running. You know, the Lord has a plan for your life, and it's not always something that you love. I remember Josh McDowell telling the story one time about these kids who hopped over a fence, climbed over a chain link fence so that they could go swimming in a pool at night. And it was totally against the rules. They were trespassing, but they didn't want to obey. And so the young man, first one in, was all excited, dove off the diving board. And it was only when he got near the side of the pool that he realized there was no water in the pool. He broke his neck and was paralyzed for the rest of his life. Those fences that God puts around your life, those are important. If God says, don't go here, don't go there. If God says, do go here, then go there. But you have to let the Lord decide. He's not trying to hurt you. He's trying to do the best thing for you. And Jonah doesn't believe it. And sometimes we don't believe it. So we're talking about Jonah's unwanted calling, Jonah's unwanted assignment. He has an assignment. He just doesn't want it. And that's how the book begins, with Jonah running. So from chapter 1, verse 1, look at how the text reads. I've provided it for you on your note page. Now the word of the Lord came unto Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah rose up to flee unto Tarshish. And we're noting here that's possibly Spain, which would be, of course, the end of dry land. As you go across Europe after Spain, you have nothing but the Atlantic Ocean. He's fleeing from the presence of the Lord. And he went down to Joppa. He found a ship going to Tarshish. So he paid the fare thereof, went down into it to go with them into Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. So the first bulleted point there, Nineveh is 600 miles due east from Israel. That's where Jonah is supposed to be going. So on your map, 600 miles to the right. But Spain is 2,000 miles due west. So on your map, 2,000 miles to the left. And the second bullet there says, God's assignments are always good, but don't always strike us as being good. And Jonah was literally 180 degrees out from God's will. Instead of going to Nineveh east, he goes to Spain west, and he could not be any more directly opposed to what God has for him. He hates the idea, and he doesn't want to do it. In the third bullet point under that text, I'm reminding you here that Jonah's life story has now, through biblical history, has now been totally defined by his resentment and disrespect for God. In other words, if you're going to tell the child the story of Jonah, it's Jonah and the whale. And by that, we mean Jonah and his punishment for disobeying God. The whale was like the electric chair. Jonah and the electric chair. He was very bad, and so he gets swallowed by a whale. And his story is defined by resentment and disobedience now. He's mad at God. He doesn't like what God has assigned him to do, and so he's disobedient. And that can happen to any of us. The kid who climbs over the chain link fence to dive into a pool, trespassing, he is now defined, because in that moment, when he broke his neck and ended up paralyzed for the rest of his life, that has been a life-defining moment. He is not the same person because he disobeyed. And at critical times in your life, if you disobey, then your life is marked by disobedience. It's defined by disobedience. Oh, that's the guy who had this come into his life because he would not follow Jesus. And so if you disobey frequently enough or at critical times, that just becomes the defining feature of your life story, disobedience to God. And you don't want that to happen. That happens with such things as who you date and marry. You know, who you marry defines your life. You get that one wrong, and that is life defining. That changes everything. That happens sometimes with moments of dishonesty, some sort of lapse of integrity. And when you do that, it defines your life. And you never know in advance. When you wake up in the morning, you don't usually know, oh, this is going to be a day that defines my life as a disobedient follower of Jesus. You don't usually know that on a particular day when you wake up, but that's what happens. One fellow who had defected from our faith into liberalism, he still remained a minister, but he began to teach untruth. And he was talking candidly one time to a friend. And he said, would you like to know when I quit teaching what the Bible really said? And the fellow said, yes, I would. He said, I was standing up to preach one day, and I looked across the congregation, and there was a wealthy man visiting our church. And I tailored my message that day so as not to offend that wealthy man who was an unbeliever. And that was the day it all began for him. And that marked the beginning of his Jonah experience to be disobedient, resentful against God, and never the same. So you want to be very careful when the Lord gives you an assignment, when he gives you a calling. If you think, well, I'm not going to obey that today, or I'm not going to obey that now, you realize at some point your disobedience defines your life. It's simply who you are. And you don't want that to happen to you. So learn the lesson of Jonah. Does that raise any questions or observations before we leave that point? Just know that it's very subtle. You have a lapse of integrity and somebody catches you in that moment. That could be one of the biggest days of your life. And you're not going to like that. So that's Jonah. The next point we have here, you see in bold font. There's often an initial ecstasy of liberation when one sins. It's really interesting how that happens. So chapter 1, verse 6, they're in the middle of a storm. And the text says, so the shipmaster came to Jonah and said unto him, what meanest thou, O sleeper? Arise, call upon thy God, if so be that God will think upon us that we perish not. So they're in this storm, and literally everybody on that boat is frightened for life. I mean, they realize that they may not survive the storm. Everybody on that boat is frightened but one, Jonah, and he's sleeping like a baby. Is that interesting? The calm, the peace that passes understanding. He's in a relatively small vessel on the Mediterranean Sea, and the ship is likely to go down, and he is sleeping soundly. That aggravates us. We think, you know, I've been praying for this person to come around, that the Lord would trouble him, that the Lord would bother his conscience. And he's like bulletproof. So does it not bother you? Does it not sting you in your heart to see what you're doing? How could you go to sleep at night with a conscience like that? Jonah went to sleep at night just fine. And he is in a storm. Think, may it never be. And yet that's the situation. When you first disobey, you see the bolted point under that. Jonah must have been pleased with himself enough to sleep soundly in a storm at sea. And Hebrews 11:25 talks about the pleasures of sin for a season. It is great for a while. Sin can be such a lark for a while. But that's the trick. It's only for a season. And right now, Jonah is pretty pleased with himself. The second bullet says, the fact that a person doesn't feel pangs of conscience yet in his flight from God does not indicate that the person is out of danger. Say, how can you even sleep at night doing what you're doing? He says, well, believe me, I sleep just fine. Maybe he does, but that doesn't mean he's out of danger. Jonah is just about to be swallowed by a whale. And he feels perfectly fine about the direction of his life. So you should know that as much as you would like for all evil people to have a pang of conscience, Jonah does it. He seems pretty at peace with it all. Pat? Yeah, very good. It feels like relief. Could you hear Pat when she first got involved with Right to Life? Surveys indicated that the number one first feeling that the women had after receiving an abortion was relief, liberation. And that's true. I remember, I mean, it's not quite the same as Jonah, but when I was a kid, there was a lady across the street that would hire me to do little jobs. And sometimes I didn't want any more money. I just wanted to play. And I remember one time I was digging. I don't remember why I was digging, but I was digging. And my friend from a couple houses down came by and said, let's do something. I don't remember what we were going to do. Let's go play. And so I left my shovel and everything. I said, yeah, I don't want to do this work anymore. I'm out of here. And I left the shovel sitting right there. And I went over to my friend's house and I was playing. And pretty soon the phone rang. And it was Mrs. Cashman on the phone. And she was kind of hurt. And she said, Dave, you just left. Is everything okay? You don't want to do the work? And I remember being kind of ashamed of myself. And I'm sorry. I just wanted to come over here and play with my friend Ricky. And so I just left. She said, well, that's okay. You don't have to do it. I wish you would have just told me. It's like, oh, yeah. And I was ashamed. But when I first left that shovel and walked away, like, yeah, this is way better. I like this a lot better. And that's what Jonah was doing. Like, oh, the Lord wants me to go to Nineveh. I'm going to Spain. It'll be a great adventure. And the Lord lives in the Holy Land, right? So he won't pay any attention. He just lives in the Holy Land. So I'm going to leave him in the Holy Land and I'm going to Spain. And won't that be grand? And he's sleeping like a baby because he's expecting everything to be so good. And along comes a whale in just a little while. Jim, wow. He must have had Valium or something, huh? That's the narcotic of liberation. I'm free. One time, Teresa and I were driving down to Sumter, South Carolina, where my parents lived there. We were actually in Rod's borrowed Celebrity Chevrolet Celebrity, and we're in the middle of the night, running whatever 60 miles an hour, and pretty soon this dog comes trotting across the interstate, and he's kind of a dark colored dog, and trotting. I mean, we couldn't hardly flinch. I mean, what were we supposed to do? And sure enough, we smacked him in the head so hard, and it had to be the head because it wasn't soft and spongy. And it broke the little headlight assembly out of Rod's car. And, of course, the dog died. And I remember thinking, which I always remember this, how happy he looked. Like, I'm liberated. I get to run away. It comes trotting across, you know, the trot that dogs have when they're happy. He's trotting across. They're just as happy as he can be. And bow, it was the end of his life. And yeah, it's just liberating. Isn't it great to be free? You know, break God's leash and let's go to Spain. And it seems like great fun. But it never turns out that way. The pleasure of sin is just for a season. You can never forget that. Amy. So all around us are people who have gone down the wrong path for some period of time and are stuck. You know, what feels like liberation is sometimes bondage. The thing we like to ask if somebody, let's say that we're talking about somebody going on the internet looking at bad pictures. And we say, so why do you want to do that? Why do you do that? And the person says, well, I just like to. It brings, you know, joy, pleasure, whatever. We say, well, can you stop? And almost all the time the answer is no. Well, at that point, you're not dealing with pleasure. You're dealing with bondage. If you can't stop, then you're in bondage. So you feel like you're free. But if you're so free, why can't you stop? And that happens in relationships. You know, I'm just hanging around with these friends at school because I enjoy being with them. Yeah, can you stop hanging around them? Or now would you compromise your soul to get their approval? Because if you can't stop, then you're not liberated. You're in bondage. That's your trouble. You're in bondage to these people or to this romance or to this entertainment, whatever we're talking about. And so it feels like liberation, it feels like fun. But if it's so fun, why can't you stop? And then what happens is at a critical time. So one time, I'm 15 years old. And these two girls in my neighborhood are mad at their parents and decide to run away. And I said, well, my sister drives. So we took these two girls, my sister and I and somebody else, and these two girls loaded up into her car. And we drove the girls to Kankakee State Park, which is about maybe an hour or an hour and a half from our home in the Chicago area. And they had a tent and a bag of groceries. We helped them set up their tent. And then we drove home. And I needed gas for my motorcycle. So I said, Mom, can I siphon gas out of the Galaxy for the motorcycle? That's where I always got my gas. It was just always there. You siphon it out. And she said, David, what are you doing? While we're gone, of course, the parents are tearing up the neighborhood to find these girls. And it's discovered, well, Dave and Patty have been mysteriously missing all morning. And she said, David, you can't help people run away. I said, oh, I wasn't running away. I'm just helping somebody. But I mean, if you're a little older, those are the kinds of things in life that define who you are. I mean, that could have been really bad for me if the parents had decided to press charges and they were talking about it. So I'd have been a 15-year-old with a criminal record. And it was just dumb. I mean, they were bad girls and I knew they were bad girls, but they're neighborhood girls and, you know, you got to do somebody a good turn, right? And so by just being stupid, you can be defined as stupid. You know, you would be the Proverbs fool if at critical moments you do the wrong thing. So Jonah feels happy. He's delighted. And yet he's making the worst mistake in his life. So you have to beware of deviating from God's assignment for your life. Don't deviate from that, not in a big area, not in a little area. How many times? You know, it all starts with one step. As a youth pastor, I'm pleading with this girl, please do not run away. She told her parents she's going to run away. And I think she might have even been like 17, so she could technically sort of legally run away. And she wants to go live with her boyfriend who essentially lives in a ghetto. And I'm looking at her and I'm saying, please don't do this. You know, the boyfriend and his mom are all good with this. Yeah, come live with us. Please don't do this. This is life changing. And she's really a nice girl. There's no accounting for this. So this is my last. She's going to leave that afternoon. I'm pleading with her, please don't do this, Trina. And she says, well, I've made up my mind. And so off she goes. Essentially, from that day forward, her life was never the same. That defined her life. And it was just one day. Of course, there are days leading up to the one day. But on that day, she felt very good about it all. She was happy, you know, liberated. This is great. It's an adventure. I finally get to shake off the shackles of my Christian faith and my mother and all of those things. And that was a day that defined who she was. Very frightening. Well, okay, so look at the next heading there. This is a point that often occurs to me, and I imagine it occurs to you as well in bold font there. God seems to us to be too hard and too soft at the same time. In other words, sometimes God seems to be stern with his saints, like Jonah, and indulgent toward his enemies, like Nineveh. So why is God going to be so overly kind and gracious to the Ninevites who are so rotten, and yet he's going to get sore at Jonah because Jonah doesn't want to go preach to them? I mean, not wanting to preach to bad people, it's not exactly the worst crime in the world. But for that, the Lord is going to bring Jonah to the brink of death with a whale. But the Ninevites don't go to the brink of death, and they're so rotten. So we are conflicted. why is God so stern with his children and so indulgent toward his enemies? That bothers us. We were talking the other day about cowardliness. A school teacher, for example, is cowardly if the school teacher sweet talks the bullies and is harsh toward the good kids. Why would a teacher ever sweet talk the bullies and then be harsh and stern to the good kids? The best answer is cowardliness. What should happen there is that the bullies are dealt with a firm hand, and the kind kids are dealt with sweet talk. But if you're cowardly, you're always kowtowing to the bullies and you're mean to the nice people because they'll never hurt you. Almost sometimes we would accuse God of being a coward. So to the Ninevites, just endless grace. To the Jonahs, a whale. Why would God do that? So I mentioned in Sunday school class a few weeks ago, I had a pastor friend who was telling me that his wife underwent a big battle with breast cancer, but is doing pretty well right now. But you know how it is. There's always a question. And he said, here's the irony of it. What do you think of this? So my wife, who has always been so chaste, so aware of modesty, has breast cancer. And then all of the girls who are using their bodies to bring destruction and dishonor to God and his cause, they're perfectly fine. So what sense does it make that my wife gets breast cancer and not the ones who are using their bodies badly? Why not give them breast cancer? And almost sometimes we think, you know what the trouble with God is? He's too hard on me, and he's awfully easy on somebody else. And you can imagine that it would be easy for Jonah to come to that conclusion. And you could almost understand why he'd want to go to Spain. So we have chapter 1, verse 9 provided for you here. And Jonah said unto the people on the ship, I am a Hebrew, and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, which hath made the sea and the dry land. I think that's such an interesting statement because he says, I fear the Lord, the God of heaven. You do? Well, then why is it that when he gave you an assignment, you don't do it? You don't fear him very much, do you? Why is it when he says go east, you go west? You don't fear him very much, do you? So who are you, Jonah? He says, oh, I'm a Hebrew person and I fear the Lord. You don't fear him very much. It's like a believing unbeliever. He fears God, but not really. He's a prophet, but he doesn't like God's assignment. So he's not much of a prophet. He's not going where he's sent. And so we see that Jonah is probably behaving a lot more like we behave than we wish. And so there he goes running off because he probably thinks that the Lord is too indulgent. As a matter of fact, we know that's exactly what he thinks because after the revival, he says so. Well, does that raise any questions or observations before we leave that point? It is difficult sometimes to reconcile why the Lord is working this way with one person and this way with another person. Jim, good point. I think so. Josiah. Oh, Jim was saying only earth-minded people would ask the question of why the Lord would do this in this case and this in this case, because for the believer, the reward is going to be so rich that it will be well worth it. And someday we might be embarrassed that we ever doubted the Lord on those things. Josiah. Yeah, that's a really good insight. That's right. Jim. And then John. That's right. And to whom much is given, much is required. So if the Lord's given you a lot, then, you know, step up to the plate and act like a big leaguer. John. Yeah, John is saying that this was extraordinary that a true prophet of God would be asked to go to a faraway foreign country and do his ministry. I mean, who else was ever asked to do anything like this? So you can understand that Jonah would feel a little put upon to be the first one, the groundbreaker in this idea. And it would have seemed sort of backwards and even like madness. So, Yeah, I mean, there was a great sense that God is in the Holy Land. God is in Israel. So why would I want to go to Nineveh? If I'm going to go to Nineveh, I'd choose to go to Spain. If it came to that, we'll leave God and he can stay in the Holy Land and I'll go elsewhere. So, but at any rate, you can almost appreciate why Jonah runs, because God seems too stern for him and too lenient for those Ninevites. And we get the same sort of accusations swirling around in our minds, too, sometimes. Well, look at the bottom of that page. And this is great. We're asking the question here. Should we continue saying, as we often do, that God is a perfect gentleman and he only intervenes where he is invited? Well, probably not. Chapter 1, verse 4. But the Lord sent out a great wind into the sea. So he's intervening. There was a mighty tempest storm in the sea, so that the ship was like to be broken. In verse 17. Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights. So verse 4 says, the Lord sent a storm. And then verse 17 says, the Lord prepared a great fish. So we keep saying, the Lord is a perfect gentleman, and he never goes where he isn't invited. There is some truth to that, and I myself say that sometimes. But actually, the Lord was not invited to intervene in Jonah's case. Jonah did not invite the Lord to come along on the trip, to start a storm, to prepare a fish. He was not invited. The Lord just decided to do that on his own. And while it's true that oftentimes, you know, in Revelation 3, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I'll come in. And we say, God is a perfect gentleman. You don't want him? Then he won't barge in. You open the door, invite him in, and he'll have supper with you. That is true in many situations. But you have to be a little careful when you think of that as a carte blanche way of God's dealing with men. Because he was knocking at Jonah's door, and Jonah wasn't opening. So the Lord said, I think I'm going to send a storm. I'm going to prepare a great fish, and you're going down. And he intervened, whether Jonah liked it or not. And in the first bullet there, we have this idea that sometimes God intervenes right away in life. So right away, there's some sort of a thing that happens, even rather supernaturally. And this didn't go well at all. God intervened right away. Sometimes the Lord lets you go and go and go, but always eventually he intervenes, because you're going to die and then every knee has to bow. So sometimes the intervention is rather immediate, sometimes rather remote, but God will always intervene. And we should be careful when we say, oh, he's a perfect gentleman. He will never come where he's not wanted. Well, he wasn't wanted here, and he showed up in a big way. Does that raise any questions or observations? Rob? Yeah, that's great. Rob is pointing out that, you know, there's evidently no change of heart in Jonah. I mean, he is the reluctant prophet, so he goes and he preaches in Nineveh. You get to the end of the book, and it's not like he's all tame and docile and malleable in God's hands. He still is resistant and rebellious. That's just how the book ends. And so if God's intervention was to soften Jonah, that didn't seem to happen. If God's intervention was to save the Ninevites, that didn't really seem to happen. The Ninevites' revival was very short-lived, a flash in the pan in history. There's no indication that anything good ever happened in Nineveh. You come 60 or 70 years later, and Nineveh is still the headquarters of idolatry, still attacking Israel, and there's no indication anywhere in history that this was anything more than a flash in the pan revival. Well, that doesn't mean that nobody was saved, but it means it was probably, for the most part, the Lord intervening to give them a chance to respond, whether they did or not. Now they had a chance, and that was very gracious of the Lord. But the intervention of God was not obviously successful, if you think that the intervention of God was to change Jonah's heart, because Jonah just seems as cantankerous at the end of the book as he was at the beginning. Kathy and then Jim. That's right. The intervention might be partly for us who read this all of these centuries later. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. They don't know their right hand from their left. Jim and then Mike and then Charlotte. Yeah, the Assyrians were famous for their brutality and their sensuality. They're very, very bad people. Mike, you get called to work hard at an endeavor that doesn't really pan out. It happens often. Charla was saying that when they were doing the ministry to the homeless people, she and Tom would sometimes talk back and forth and say, perhaps the only reason we did this was that so one day God would be able to tell those people, I gave you a chance. And if that's the way it is, then Tom and Charlotte could live with that. John. Yeah, John is saying that Jesus made reference, you know, the sign of Jonah for the resurrection. And so in this, embedded in this story is a prophecy of Jesus, essentially, and a metaphor of Jesus' resurrection. And so there were all kinds of layers happening here. And maybe that was a very, very important layer. We need a metaphor about the resurrection. So there it is. Okay, so if you'll turn the page over, we have just a couple of things to say on this back page, and we can go quickly because they are related. The first one is just answering the question now. We've on the last line of the previous page, page 200 in your notes, we saw that the fish swallowed Jonah. So the question comes up, is Jonah's story one of survival or resurrection? I was in seminary one time. I don't remember which seminary because I went to two. But one of my seminaries, and I suspect that this is a story of resurrection and not survival. So I raised my hand when the teacher was talking about it, and I said, you know, some scholars think that maybe this is a story not of surviving for 3 days in the belly of a whale, but of resurrection. Do you think that's true? And he said, no. And he went to the next question. It's like, no? You're not even going to comment? Like, give me a little more than no. It's just sort of a slap in the face. Be quiet. So anyway, here's what I wish that he would interact with. The first bullet says, some of the language of the passage lends itself better to death and resurrection than to survival. So I've underlined certain things for you. And notice, does this sound to you like he's surviving or like he's dying? So from verse 1 here, Jonah prayed unto the Lord his God. This, by the way, is chapter 2. Jonah prayed unto the Lord his God out of the fish's belly and said, I cried by reason of my affliction unto the Lord. He heard me out of the belly of hell. Well, we know that deceased people don't die and go to the belly of a whale. In Old Testament times, deceased people die and go to hell, which has a good side and a bad side. Good side, paradise. Bad side, torment. So he didn't say he survived. He said he was in hell. Well, that doesn't sound like the fish's belly, but it says the belly of hell. So, you know, which way do we go in the metaphor? Don't know. Anyway, he says, he cried, and thou heardest my voice. In verse 5, the waters surrounded me, even to the soul. The depths closed me round about. The weeds were wrapped around my head. I went down to the bottoms of the mountains. The earth with her bars was around me. The earth with her bars. Well, I mean, if it was a whale, you could possibly say the ribs are like bars. But it doesn't say the whale with its ribs. It says the earth with bars. Well, that's a description of hell. The gates of hell shall not prevail against it. It doesn't sound like the talk to me of survival, but of death and then later resurrection. Verse 6, I went down to the bottoms of the mountains. The earth with their bars was about me forever. Yet hast thou brought up my life from corruption. You brought up my life from corruption. That sort of sounds like resurrection. O Lord my God, verse 10, and the Lord spoke unto the fish, and it vomited Jonah out on the dry land. The second bullet says, Jesus said that Jonah's experience was somehow like his own death, burial, and resurrection. Jesus didn't survive the tomb. He was dead in the tomb. So, and Jesus said, I'm going to give you the sign of Jonah in Matthew 12, verse 40. So people say, well, that would take a miracle. No man could ever survive in the belly of a whale or the belly of a fish or whatever we're talking about. I said, who said he survived? I didn't say he survived. There's nothing in the language of the text that says he survived. It just says he had to go in there for 3 days and three nights and come out and talk to people. Either way, you're going to have a notable miracle, whether it's survival or resurrection, I don't know that it matters very much. But there you have at least some language that might lend itself to not surviving in the belly of the whale. Does that raise any questions or observations? Sharla? Yeah, so Sharla's saying, what if it had been a resurrection? And even then, Jonah was such a stinker. Like, did you not learn anything? But even if it was survival, did you not learn anything? I mean, why are you so brassy to think you could challenge God? Are you just stark raving mad? And the answer is for all of us, yeah, we're pretty much crazy most of the time. You see the part that says payday someday, just notice. While he was so happy, you know, sleeping soundly at sea during the storm, it didn't continue like that, right? Eventually, you realize. And so he said, I cried by reason of my affliction unto the Lord. When my soul fainted within me, I remember the Lord. And you see the language there. He says, I cried, affliction, faint. So here's the guy sleeping soundly in the storm. Sure, the pleasures of sin for a season. But what happens after the season? Oh, after the season, it's not so great, is it? I cried, affliction, faint. It's not so fun now, is it? It's always fun for the first part. It's the second part that we don't love. And lastly, Jonah had a temporary repentance while in the whale. Very temporary. You see in verse 4, then I said, I am cast out of thy sight, yet I will look again toward the holy temple. I will sacrifice unto thee with the voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that which I have vowed. Salvation is of the Lord. Very temporary, as Charlotte was alluding to just a moment. That all sounds really great, but as soon as he's burped out, he seems to have forgotten it. And you end up in chapter 4, verse 1, the Lord and following. The Lord says, do you do well to be angry with me? Is that the right thing for you to be angry with me? And he says, I do well to be angry unto death. Yes, I'm right and you're wrong. I'm just going to stay angry. Like, yeah, what happened to that talk when you were down in the whale's belly or even in hell? And he said, I'm going to make the sacrifice of thanksgiving. Seems like you forgot all about that, didn't you? And so very temporary repentance. And temporary repentance is the path for emotional distress and for the rebuke of God. And so that comes.